Our next speakers are Wayne and Sarah Jacobson. They are our featured speakers, and we are really fortunate to have them here. Wayne was here last night at the church and had a conversation with those that were here. It was really nice. They have been married 34 years. They live in Southern California, so they came from quite a distance, too. Two adult children. They have two grandchildren. And it's been nice getting to know them a little bit. Wayne has authored many books, Loves Me, So You Don't Want to Go to Church Anymore, Living in the Father's Affection. Wayne and Sarah together work with Lifestream Ministries. That's what they've got. They do some podcasts regularly and just are here to share with us their heart. Their topic is Only and Always, and I'd like you to welcome them very warmly. Thank you very much for being here. Come on up.
Hi, I'll bring Sarah up in a moment. She's not a speaker, and seeing her name on a list of featured speakers scares her to death. She's my wife, first and foremost. She's the love of my life, and you said we've had 34 years together. And I got to say this, Jeff, after listening to you talk and Kathy, you've got it easy, dude. Really. Sarah does stuff like we'll be talking over lunch and she'll say, you know what I think they should do? They. Who is they? There's no antecedent to this pronoun, so I'm back to they. And I'm going, who? It's a conversation we had a week ago. And she's got something new to add to it, and she thinks she can start it with just they. And so just a she in the middle of a conversation doesn't sound too bad. Sarah will come up in a moment, because she is. It's not that she doesn't like standing up front. She doesn't. But she has lots of wonderful things to say about our journey and things God has done in her. And you'll find probably more of those out, less when she's standing up here with me, as when you talk to her during break time or lunchtime or ask her questions or whatever. I mean, she's a great lady to share her journey. She's just not comfortable being up here with a microphone and the spotlight. So I'll bring up in a minute, though. We'll do a little talking out of her, perhaps. You know, the worst advice I've ever heard at a wedding, and Jeff, I hope you haven't done this. I'm always scared when I share this and go, oh, that's part of your marriage thing, too. But I heard a pastor say to a friend of my daughter's as he was marrying them, he read 1 Corinthians 13, as many people are wont to do at wedding ceremonies. The love chapter, love is kind, love is patient, love doesn't keep record of wrongs, love's not jealous, and he's giving them that spiel. And when he finished it, he looked at him and said, I'm going to give you a homework assignment. And I want you to do this every week for the rest of your life. I want you to choose a night of the week when you'll sit down after dinner and you will open this chapter again and you will read 1 Corinthians 13 to each other about all that love is. And then you will ask each other, you'll look into each other's eyes and say, honey, how have I failed to live up to these things this week in our lives? And I'm sitting in the audience going, that is the dumbest piece of advice I've ever heard anyone give anybody. Yeah, let's every week check in how bad we're failing this new list of requirements that we're supposed to meet to be good Christians living in the world. That's not why 1 Corinthians 13 was written. 1 Corinthians is not the Ten Commandments of the New Testament. They're not how we're supposed to go out and pretend to be. 1 Corinthians 13 is the description of how God loves us. It's so when we see those things in our life, we'll know they're coming from the Father. Because it's the Father who is the essence of love Himself. If Sarah and I would have sat down once a week over our 34 years of marriage and talked about all the ways we had failed to love each other perfectly that week, we wouldn't be standing here today as a married couple. No way. Wouldn't happen. And we come from a line of a well-married family. The topic we had was Only and Always. That's a title of a book that we're writing about marriage. Sarah and I sharing some of our bits of it. Only and Always. And that's the promise of love, isn't it? From the moment people fall in love, that first moment of connecting with another human being, that special him or her that becomes part of your life. And the feeling of it, and you see it in Hollywood movies, you see it in great literature. The promise of love is I love you only. There's an exclusivity to the kind of love that romantic love is. It's not, well, I love you. And there's lots of other people I want to love too. I mean, we see it all the time in the media, people who try and get away with that. But real romantic love from both is, I love you only. And there's also not only exclusivity with it, there's a sense of eternality in it. And I will love you always. And yet, that's the hardest thing to do. We live in a culture where divorce is rampant, where marriages, yes, people get married with all those stars in their eyes, and yes, we want to make this go, and yes, and out of the infatuation of the romantic relationship, and even the marriage, and the honeymoon year, and all of that, where our lives is, yes, we're going to do this forever. Then life sets in. And the problem with marriage is, at least in ours, two very selfish people got married 34 years ago. We thought we loved each other. We told each other we did. We told each other that we're always going to love each other, and you're so special to me, and I'm going to always treat you well. And then life sets in. When you're no longer dating and you're together a few hours a week till you're together 24 hours a day, it's just if you work together. If you don't, maybe less, but you're at least around each other all the time, and now you can't pretend to be. You can't put on your best face because you're going out for a few hours. You're with each other all the time. You see each other that first moment you wake up in the morning. We see each other just in the normal course of life, and then the selfishness, what we can not pretend forever, begins to emerge in our lives. The challenge of only and always is, you know, what Scripture I think holds as the ideal is that we would find that one special person, love them and live with them for life. And we come from a family of longevity. My parents just celebrated a year and a half ago their 60th wedding anniversary. Sarah's parents celebrated their 49th wedding anniversary the year her mother passed away with cancer. In those years, Sarah's dad had Parkinson's disease 42 of those 49 years. So it wasn't just living together in this great little romantic adventure. It's also enduring one of the most difficult challenges that a marriage could face, the incapacitation progressively of one of the partners. We watched our parents love each other over long time years, work through the fights, work through the selfishness, work through the anger, work through the frustration, keep finding their way into a growing, loving relationship. And that's been our model. And I want to talk about the passion in our heart that is only and always. And I don't want that to be exclusive of you who are on a second marriage or a third to say, well, see, I've already missed God's best for me. Only and always is the passion that God brings two people together. And yeah, that sometimes breaks apart in our world by death. Our best friend back home is widowed recently at the death of her husband, and we're walking her through that. So only and always for her now is going to mean something else. Some of you have been through divorces. We've been through marriages that haven't worked, and may have been because of our selfishness, may have been because of someone else's, may have been because of both. Sarah and I don't stand here, to be honest with you, and say we've had 34 years of marriage, and that's some kind of a merit badge in the body of Christ, because it isn't. We're only together because we kept working at it. We got through our mistakes. As I told you, two very selfish people got married. I'll tell you a little bit about my selfishness, and I'm going to tell you a little bit about hers. And she'll come up and tell you it's true later. I grew up, for whatever Rhea said last night, I grew up a bit of a Pharisee. Pharisees by nature are very angry people. I'd done a lot of stuff trying hard for God and was going to change the world for God at 21 years of age, or 22. We were college sweethearts. We dated 3.5 years, met our freshman year, dated 3.5 years through college, got married 6 days after we graduated together, moved to California, where I was hired to be an associate pastor of a Four Square church out in Fresno, California. I was an angry guy, an impatient guy, and a guy that was going to change the world for God out of just my sheer determination because I was better than everybody else I knew. Reed, that's a very sick young man, okay? I want you to hear it that way because that's the way I mean it. Sarah's selfishness is really different than mine. Sarah grew up without a sense of who she was as a person and the oppression that women often suffer in religious contexts. I realize you Presbyterians do it better than most. Don't do it as well as others do, is what I mean to say that, in terms of oppression. The traditions we grew up in were very repressive of women. Sarah grew up without any sense of who she was as a person, just fitting into the expectations of everyone around her. Her selfishness was not to be honest or be real with me, but to give me everything I wanted. That's not bad for me, is it? 20 years of marriage, I thought I'd marry June Cleaver. That's Beaver Cleaver's mother, if you don't know. I'll leave it to Beaver story. She was one of the best housewives ever. House was immaculate. Kids were immaculate. Gardens at one point had 8,000 Irish blooms in the gardens around our house. She could do. She plays piano. She helps other people. She taught things and helped in Bible studies and things to help people grow in the pastorate that I was a part of. She was incredibly proficient about everything she did, but inside she was dying because she was pretending to be what she was not. We didn't find out until 20 years of marriage that she was a pretender. And I didn't know. My passion has always been the two become one flesh. God brings two people together, two damaged, broken, selfish people together. And if they can learn to love each other and learn to live in love, lives get transformed. And now, 34 years down the road, I have the best partner I could ever conceive of to share this journey of life together. In the joys of it, in the celebration of our children and sometimes the struggles they go through, in the celebration of our grandchildren, in the journey of life that we share as to how we pay bills and what we're going to do next and where we vacation and who we hang out with and all those things. We've become this wonderful, wonderful partnership. I know I said to Sarah on the day I married her, I love you and I trust you. I now look back 34 years later and go, whoa, that was stupid. I had no idea what those things meant. And after 34 years now, I think I have a little bit of an understanding what it means to love and trust this woman. Marriage, unfortunately, in a human sense, I think we say we love each other. What in a human sense of how we mean love, I had a friend who defined it this way. Saying we love each other is the mutual accommodation of self-need. You know, we say we fall in love because there's something that person does for you. And yes, when we're in love, we do really stupid things to prove that we're in love, to show our love to the person. We serve them in ways we never will. I'll give you a great example of that. My brother went through a very painful divorce in his early 30s. He was redating a different gal later on after that marriage was gone. He was redating this woman. And we were up in a place where we used to camp out as kids. And it's by a creek that's ice cold. And my brother hates cold water. The whole time growing up, he never swam in that creek, ever. And we're up there, just our families together, and he's got his new girlfriend up there with him, and we're all standing there by the lake, and she takes off her little top she had over, swimming suit, and she dives into this deep pool of ice cold water and swims across it. And I'm going, wow, gee, I used to do that as a kid, but now I don't need that much cold water. I don't usually jump in that creek anymore. And my brother got up and pulled his T-shirt off and had a swimsuit on and dove in and swam across with her. All the brothers, I had three brothers. All the rest of us are sitting, and my dad, and we all look at each other and we just bust out laughing. Who is he kidding? And he swims across the creek with her and they sit on this rock together. And I'm going, now he's got to swim back. That was really... And we're laughing at him. He goes, what? Who are you kidding? He goes, I love this now. Who are you kidding? Yes, and as soon as they got married, he's never been in that creek since. Now, I don't think he's lying. I mean, he really is so in love that he doesn't feel the water. But after you get married and live together for a while, suddenly the water's cold again. Suddenly things change and we begin to discover who we really are. Now the choice is. And the best the world offers us. The best that you can do in your own human effort is find through negotiation this level of mutual accommodation of self-need. I'll give you enough of what you want, Sarah. You give me enough of what we want. And if we can keep finding this harmonious balance of this mutual accommodation of self-need, we get to say we're in love. And then when we can't find it anymore, then people talk about falling out of love. It just doesn't work anymore. She doesn't care about me. He doesn't care. He doesn't meet my need. You don't complete me anymore. That's the dumbest language I've ever heard about love. I'll warn you right now, if you're looking for someone to complete you, you're in trouble. If it's not Jesus that completes us, your partner will not. If you need someone to be whole, you'll never be whole. Sarah doesn't complete me. Oof, it's weird language now. It sounds so romantic when you hear it. Sarah and I are fellow travelers on a journey through life. We believe God brought us together. She was 21, I was 22. We've been learning for 30, as I told you, 20 of those years, I grew up with a pretense of a woman who was giving me everything I ever wanted. Every discussion we had, Sarah will tell you this, when I'd say, honey, what do you want to do about this? She had a thought, well, gee, I'd like to do this. But she never thought her thought had any value or worth. So what she would do, she would discount that thought. That's what I'd like to do. That's the movie I'd like to see. That's where I would like to go on vacation. That's where she throws it out and she's going, what would Wayne want me to say? And then she would say that. And I'm going, really? It's amazing. I married a woman who likes everything I like. What didn't wake me up about that for 20 years? But I was so absorbed in my life, my ministry, trying to become what Jesus wanted me to be. I never paused. One of the greatest regrets of my life is in those 20 years, I never stopped long enough to say, are you for real? I used to joke at marriage conference. I didn't. You know what? Sarah and I have never had a fight. People go, oh, really? Yeah, because it takes two to fight, and she won't fight. So I don't. And then to realize how dysfunctional that was. I was boasting about something that was purely dysfunctional because Sarah had not been honest about her desires and her needs in the marriage. And 15 years ago, God began to put her through a process that reduced her to the place of realizing she didn't have a clue who she was. And she said, I don't even know why I'm on the planet. And God began to do a work in here, and it scared the dickens out of me. I remember laying one night in our bedroom, and we were on the bed, and she's going through this, and I'm, you know, honey, can I pray for you? Can I help you? And she said, I don't want your help. What, me? I'm Mr. Super Pastor, Super Author Guy. Of course you want my help. Without my help, you are nothing. And I didn't say any of that, but that's all going on in my head. What do you mean you don't want my help? And she said, God and I need to sort this out together. And I just need some space. Well, this has been going on for at least a year, year and a half at that point. And I'm feeling more and more pushed out of her life. And I'm not thinking we're getting through this. I remember looking at her and saying, are we going to get through this? And she said, what do you mean? I said, are you going to be one of those women who find yourself and it's with Julio the pool boy? Now, Sarah went through this transformation over a 2-year process. She'd be happy to talk about it with you. I wish she would share it up here, but it's really more difficult for Sarah to stand here and do this the way I'm doing it, though. You'll be up here shortly, babe. I'll never forget how she looked at me. She looked at me and she said, of course. And it set my heart so at ease. Somehow I thought our relationship was at risk here. What Sarah needed from me in that moment of our marriage was not to be the counselor I'd always been, not to give her answers that might even be the right answers, but that she needed to discover those from the Father herself. She needed God to breathe into her life and make her, help her see the woman He made her to be, and He put her on the planet. It took another year or two to get through that process. During that time, Sarah never treated me other than graciously. Sarah was still my wife. She was still, we're still partnering in life together. We'd still laugh together. But I knew there was a deep, deep struggle going on in her heart, and I knew I wasn't part of it. And I wanted to be. I wanted to fix it, because guys, we're fixers, right? And it was something I could not fix. And God took her through a process where she began to understand who Sarah was on the planet, what gifts God had put in her life, where she had value, where her opinions mattered. And for 20 years, we hardly ever had a discussion about anything. The post-96 Sarah, we have a discussion about everything now. Because Sarah has worth in her own heart. She has worth before the Father. And I guess where I want to aim our little talks with you today in a couple of sessions is to go back to a verse that's not at all about marriage. It's just Jesus saying at the end of His life to His disciples, I'm going to give you a new command. The old command, you remember, came up 3 or 4 times in Jesus' life. I was asked about a year and a half ago now, I guess. There was a group of people studying, trying to create a new academic discipline, the study of godly love. And there's 18 universities with researchers that are trying to create a new academic discipline that combines theology and religious studies and sociology and psychology and philosophy into a new academic study, which is the study of godly love. And they were interviewing practitioners of this godly love. And somehow, because of my work with the Shack and the book He Loves Me, they wanted to come talk to me. And so I said, yeah, come over. And they came over, and it was a couple of researchers from Akron, Ohio, and they were sitting in my front room. And I said, tell me what you're doing. I don't understand this study at all. And they said, well, you know the Great Command. And I said, well, what's the Great Command? I'm going, you don't know the Great Command. I said, no, I know the Great Command. I want to know if you know the Great Command. I said, well, the Great Command is what you said. So love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. And so then I said, oh, this is an Old Covenant study. And they went, what? I said, Jesus said those words. Yeah, Jesus said those words. But when Jesus is saying those words, he's talking about the Old Covenant. It's a quote from Deuteronomy 6. Love the Lord God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. Love your neighbor as yourself. And they're going, yeah, but Jesus said it. Yeah, but at the end of his life, Jesus said this. I'm going to give you a new command. What new command? This new command replaces the old command. The best of the old was, I've got to love God with all my heart, soul, mind, and strength. What day do you ever do that? What does it mean to love God with all my heart, all my soul, all my strength, all my mind? If I watch a football game, did I rob something from God that day? What does that mean? Jesus said it this way. I'm going to give you a new command. I want you to love one another as I have loved you. And by this, the whole world will know that you are my disciple. Revelation chapter 2. The church at Ephesus is being confronted with the fact how doctrinally pure they are, but how devoid of love they were. And Jesus says to them, you've left your first love. And I don't know about you. I've heard that passage all my life at retreats and mountaintop places where you're supposed to, okay, I just got to pretend I love God as much as I did the day I got saved. Or first love in a marriage. Oh, all those sparks from when we were dating. We've got to somehow resurrect that. That's not what first love means. First love is defined in 1 John chapter 4. Where John writes in verse 10, this is love, not that we loved God, but that He first loved us and sent His Son to be the atoning sacrifice for our sins. Dear friends, since God so loved us, we also ought to love one another. No one has ever seen God, but if we love one another, God lives in us, and His love, not my love, His love, is made complete in us. See, first love, I told you the best the world offers, the best your own human effort can offer in a relationship is the mutual accommodation of self-need. We've got a trade-off. I've got to give Sarah enough of what she wants to stay in the marriage. She gives me enough of what I want to stay in the marriage. That changes all the time, so we've got to keep renegotiating that dynamic. Or, and I think this is what Jesus offers us here, it's a different way to live. Jesus came and loved those disciples in a way that He could say at the end of His ministry, just go love like I loved you. It says at the beginning, I don't have a clue how to love Sarah in a godly way. Well, I can love Sarah in terms of mutual accommodating to her self-need. I can, what is it that you need? Negotiate. I'll give you this if you give me that. But how do I love her the way Jesus loved her? Because the love of God is not about my self-need. God doesn't love us because He needed to. God loved us like I loved the day my granddaughter was born and I walked into my daughter's hospital room and that little half-hour old child was laying on her chest and I walked into the room and I'm not a baby guy. I don't love babies. I don't like babies on my lap. My daughter's baby. The moment I saw Amy, I was endeared to her. Not because of anything she had done or would ever do for me, just because she was the daughter of my daughter. That was enough. God loves us because He's deeply endeared to us. The essence of the new gospel, the new covenant, is this. You and I get to know that. You and I get an engagement with the Father through the work of the Son, where Jesus can say to us, now, go love one another as I have loved you. Not how did Jesus love the disciples and I've got to act that way, but that I woke up this morning in the love of an Abba. And if I live in the love of an Abba who's the one meeting my needs, who's the one at work in my life to bring what I need in my life to live full, to endure trial, to stand strong in the face of temptation. If God's the one that provides that for me, now Sarah doesn't have to complete me anymore. I don't have to focus my self-need in her. Now I can love the way Jesus talked about love in John chapter 15 when He said this, where He said, greater love has no one than this, that a man lay down his life for his friends. Jesus measured love not on what I can do for you that negotiates a return for me. It's now having been loved by the Father, knowing that all my needs are in His hands. Now I can begin to love Sarah in a way that doesn't focus on what Wayne needs. It just focuses on who she is. Now that's a lifetime. What I just described to you is a lifetime journey. It's not an on-off switch. Ooh, I think I'll just do that from now on. We're not bright enough. There's this old nature and new nature that wars in my own soul and being. You get that? There's times I act selfishly still around Sarah. There's times I'm impatient with her in ways I wish I were not. And I walk away from the moment going, God, I really want to learn how to be patient with her. Not, you got to stop making me impatient. That was the old deal. My actions are your fault. Instead of, no, they have to do with something I don't know about God that works in here. The last 15 years, we've grown in that friendship. We've grown where people say, you guys are always on the same page together. Gosh, some days we haven't even been in the same chapter. Today, I'll tell you, we're not only in the same chapter and somewhere on the same page, we're close to the same letter in the same sentence. I'll talk to you more about that when we talk later this afternoon. But I guess the hope I want to hold out for this relationship only and always view of marriage. God has given us to be together. Now, as I let God change me, as she lets God change her, as we walk together in this growing friendship, everything God needs to do in us gets done. Sarah, come on up here. This is my wife, Sarah. I've talked about her a lot. Be nice to her or I will hurt you. I'm kidding. We really just want to give you a chance to ask some questions about what I just talked about. Ways maybe that this would help make sense to you. But before we do that, honey, is there a... She's technically challenged as well. There you go. She hates this more than you know. But she's offered to be... Yeah, she's offered to be a good sport. Anything you want to add to what we talked about? Your own journey and how we've found our way beyond it?
You did a good job.
I did a good job?
Mm-hmm.
Is it true?
Yeah.
So you just want them to ask you questions, is that it? Something about your own journey that you'd want to, you know, just share about what you went through and all that when you were...
What
felt
part?
Like I was the enemy? Which is overstated, just for fun.
Maybe not. Well, I don't know how or what I could say about all that. He did a very concise job of that. It came during a part of our time of our life when he was having and we were having some church issues, but a large part of that stemmed from me and my family and caring for two terminally ill parents and having
in the home
yeah. Two teenage years, two kids who were in high school at that point in time, and then dealing with a sibling who was
being difficult.
Good term.
Be careful, they're recording this.
So anyhow, a lot of that came through, and it was a time when my mom was dying and my dad, who had Parkinson's disease, and I think that was the more painful part for me personally, and was having to make life and death decisions for them. And so was forcing me to come to a point to stand up for them, standing up for my parents and what I was wanting to do for them against my sister who was not on the same page as what I was. And so... And when he was talking about where I didn't have any opinions or didn't have any self-worth, for those 20 years, he didn't realize it, but also at that point in time, I didn't realize it. And so it wasn't anything that was, you know, I don't blame him for that because I didn't even know. I didn't know that. I mean, that's the way I was. I was pretty much a doormat. Don't know how I got there, but I was there. It was a very long, painful process for me to really standing up and for me standing up for my parents to stand up against something that I had just succumbed to for many years in defense mechanism. So it was a process where he took me through for about 2, 3, 4 years, something was like that, and making those decisions and needing space. And that's part of the thing where I just needed space from him. I mean, I didn't blame him, but me and God had to work that out.
Didn't want my help either.
No. And so that's where in our love for each other, and that was, he allowed me to have that space, which I'm sure was very, very hard for him. And seeing and just letting God fulfill that. And in love, sometimes it's not being right there, hovering over and not suffocating, but just being there. I mean, he loves me, but sometimes that love is going to give a little bit of backing off. And that's what he did. And on the other end, he did have to change because I was not on the backside of it. I was not the same person in which we were when we were got married. And he said that was not fair. And it probably was not fair.
I told her it was false advertising. She presented one Sarah and became another.
But love, I mean, we change as we get married. I'm not the same person. He's not the same person. We get things thrown at us in life, just going through life. And we do change. And it was interesting because I was working at a high school during this time, and one of the ladies who was there, and she knows it was going, I just shared a little bit with her and what had gone through. And we were kind of gotten separated, and then I gotten back. I mean, I had left that school and came back, and when I came back, I was pretty much on the, we were on the back side of it. And she was wondering how we were doing, and I was saying that we were doing really good. And she says, and she said that, wow, Wayne really loves you. That he was willing to change. And I'm sorry.
That's okay.
And that we do, if we really love somebody, that doesn't mean that you're going to be the same years from the, down the road, and that you love. And you change. Our love has to change. How we love each other changes. I saw that with my parents, too. Like he said, my mom and dad were married 49 years. My dad was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease when he was 35. Most of my life, I remember my dad being having Parkinson's disease when it got later in life. It was a different challenge, and he was unable to do anything for himself. And I saw that. I mean, that marriage had many, many difficulties. When you're struggling with caring for someone through a disease like that. Wayne's brother had MS and having to died when he was
49.
And we don't know that when we get married. You don't know what it's going to be. Life does get thrown things to you. And we're challenged in our relationship to really, our love for each other changes. I don't know if our love changes, but how we treat each other, how we respect each other. What each of us needs. Obviously, my mom had to care for my dad, and that changed. How that looked every day. And so, there's unknowns, and that's where, when it gets hard, a lot of times, I think people can tend to you have choices to make. We chose to continue on and work through that. You know, and sometimes in marriages, it's two people, it's two wills. It takes two of us to make it work.
Well, it's funny, I said to people through that time, I've really been married to two different women in my life, and it really couldn't be more night and day different. The pre-Sarah, the post-Sarah. I've been married to two women. It's the same person. My son was home from college during part of that process, and it used to be that Sarah would just have everybody's lunch made and put on the table at 12:01. We would all sit down to lunch, and my son's home from college, and Sarah's got other things going on in her life. She's not making lunch for us anymore. Everybody can make their own lunch, so Sarah and Julie, my daughter, had already made lunch, and Julie was home from college as well. They were sitting at the kitchen counter, and Andy and I were kind of bumping into each other as we were grabbing stuff from the fridge to make ourselves a sandwich. And Andy made the comment, he said, don't you remember when this just got done for us? And I looked over and I could see in Julie and Sarah's eyes, what you say now is going to have dire impact for the rest of the day. And so I put my arm around Andy and I said, Andy, now you know how the South felt when they lost the Civil War. And my daughter threw her fork at me across the kitchen. But it was really true. And when the first time I said that, I've been married to two Sarahs in my life. Sarah got me off to the side and she said, and which one do you love the most? And the answer is, of course, this one. Of course.
Good choice.
This is the one I live with now. No. Truly, being served by a wife who gave me everything I ever wanted, that's not a bad deal. But I wouldn't trade that for this one. This is a real person. This one has hopes and dreams and opinions and ideas and insights and wisdom. I watched Sarah carry herself in a room like she never would. Not the old Sarah, it was just a wallflower, would never have said or done the things that this woman does and says now. Yeah, we have longer discussions about everything. For a while, it was very, very difficult. It was like, oh my gosh, you really care about this too? Okay, we'd be having the conversation.
Or don't listen to the news.
Don't listen to the news? Or don't walk you in a cathedral.
Oh, that too.
But we have found that new reality. The last 5 or 6 years hasn't been difficult at all. I mean, our conversations about things are our joy. Shifting things because of her insights has been a gift in so many ways where I would have made a dumb choice on my own. And I thought about all she went through and what I had to lay down during that season not to be her fixer and somehow give her the space she needed when I was all I wanted to just end this and help her get fixed and be better. And yet, if I hadn't given her that space, here's how I see it now. I wouldn't have this today. And I wouldn't trade this today for anything. So even though it was 2 or 3 years that were very disorienting to me personally, if I would have held on to what I wanted, she either would have conformed and just stayed the old Sarah, or she probably would have had to leave. Those would have probably been the two options. I don't know what she would have chosen. I'm glad I didn't give her those options. I'm glad, I look back still, I'm amazed at the selfish, arrogant person I can be at times, that I would have said, okay, take the space you need. I still look back thinking, had to be a whole lot of grace in that, because that's not a decision that Wayne would have normally made.
But you were traveling.
Yeah, I was. And she would look at me in times and say, now, when are you going again? And
Julie even says that sometimes.
Well, we want to give you some time. I've got about 8 minutes now before our cue's over. But some comments, questions you have about this journey you'd like to ask Sarah or me? Either one? Anyone? I know. Okay. Yeah, she does.
To
women.
To take care of our children, yeah. Women. To serve, to keep our families happy. So I'm very curious, Sarah, how you decided to stop being a pleaser. You know, just...
I didn't decide that intentionally. I think what spawned that was caring for my parents the way in the situation in which I was. And when my sibling, I kind of like hit a brick wall in caring for them in the way that I still felt that they could be cared for. And I think at that point in time, it was standing up against something that I'm standing up for something I really wanted to believe. We as a family had made a decision because they were living in an apartment on the same piece of property. So it was 24/7 for me and then for the family. So I think it was not a choice. It was standing up against something that I had succumbed to and just caved in for many years. But I believed that I wanted to care for my parents in the home, and it was... I was at that point having to say no, and then that's when it was not something I chose.
There were a number of decisions at that point too. It was just kind of a season where even something we were struggling with in ministry, and she was saying, I think we should do this, because she was in so much pain that she could do no other. And I kept telling her, gosh, you're wrong. That's not what's going on. And you know, we kept trying to trust me because I'm the man of God guy that's supposed to know better. That's all a bunch of poppycock. But anyway, and it turned out she was right. Turned out as circumstances unfolded, what God had put on her heart was the right thing, and what I was trying to get her to do was the wrong thing. And we both saw it. And for her, that was huge, that she saw something, even out of her pain, that turned out to be right, and that Wayne was wrong. And that was then part of that journey of, I have things to show you and share with you and add to this marriage through you. And these were all circumstances that converged on her rather than, I'm going to go find myself. It wasn't that. Yeah, anybody else? Yes. Well, it's always hard to ask questions in a room this big, but I think it gets us to some wonderful stuff. Appreciate the courage.
My question is this. Knowing that it's a process, how was it that you were able to give up the control? Because obviously that was as big of operation as her process.
Yeah, sort of. I had always taught, even marriage seminar stuff, that the whole goal in marriage is God takes two very individual lives, and that God's desire is to make the two one flesh, to make us of one heart and one mind. So I had always taught that. So when Sarah starts on a journey that I was like, I have no idea where this is going to end. Either I'm going to live out what I've been teaching for 20 years and thought I was living and wasn't, or I was going to have to be very selfish and just demand my own way. And for me, it was because I'd already been teaching that, and I'm really nuts about, you don't teach stuff if you don't live it. I'm really nuts about that. So for me, I never felt like I was in control, because we always talked about everything and we were trying to do it together. And then when I found out she wasn't there with me in the same way I thought she had been, the biggest emotion I felt was sorrow. How could I have lived with you for 20 years and not known this? And yet, you know, she doesn't have any blame for me. She said she lived 40 years with herself and didn't know that. So, it was easy... In one sense, to just say, I want this to be real, so take the time you need. It was painful. I won't say it wasn't painful. But I don't know that I had the thoughts about, I need to let go here, or how do I control this. I don't think I fought that in a huge way, if that makes sense. But I think it's true that when our partner changes, that's what, to me, if we're going to be only and always, if we're going to take this romance of love, I love you only and I'll love you forever, and make it real, it means we've got to let our partner change. And that means any change in her is going to provoke change in me. And as I said to you, Sarah was always very gracious. She wasn't just, hey, I need my space, get out of my life. She was very gracious to me. We were still a couple, and we laughed a lot and did things that were fun. This was not a huge chasm between us. It was just this area of sorting out who she was that I wasn't involved in. That she just said, God and I need to sort this out. And then at some point, there'll be a place for you in it again. And so that was a part of the marriage. The rest of it, she was still a lovely gal to be part of. Yeah.
My question is twofold, obviously. I have tons.
Obviously.
Sarah, how did you... Wayne just kind of answered it in saying that it didn't cause a big chasm in your relationship. But when you were finding yourself and you were learning all these things and like finding your voice and becoming the woman that God... showed you he wanted you to be, how'd you love well? Because I feel like you're saying our story, and sometimes it seems like, why are you being so mean? I'm like, I'm not being mean. I'm just telling you how I feel. So how did you do that well and gracefully, one? And the other thing is, did you have a hard time struggling with feeling like you were disappointing Wayne because you weren't who you used to be?
I'm
interested in this answer.
When I started this, because I was always, I mean, everybody was always first. And when I first started this and when some of this was going on, I had a couple really, really close friends. And one of them was also the wife of who Wayne co-authored So You Don't Want to Go to Church Anymore. And she's just a dear, dear, wise woman. And when I was starting to feel that, I was feeling guilty inside because I felt I was focusing on myself. And I would literally have to talk to myself sometimes out loud because Donna would tell me, she said, no, this is about you. You got to realize that it's about you and it's not being selfish. That you have to get right with yourself. You have to understand yourself. Take care of yourself. And it kind of coincided the same thing where I was caregiver for two parents who were terminally ill. And so that whole situation is ugly for every side. It's hard for the people who are sick, but it's also hard for the caregivers. Because what happened with my mom is she didn't take care of herself, and she died first. I had to take care of myself. And so mainly to that, it was telling myself I'm not selfish. And I really had to tell myself that almost every day, that I wasn't selfish and that it is important.
Yeah, and our time's up, so we're going to cut it off here. But I'll just say this one thing. The scripture I gave you from John 13 about the new command I give you is to love one another as I have loved you. If we don't sort out A, B doesn't happen. It's not selfish to sort out in God who we are and how He loves us. When we talk about two selfish people get together, we're talking about is people with their own wants and preferences, and I'm going to get my way, and that's the kind of self. It's not selfish to have that time with God and ourselves to say, God, who are you? Who'd you make me to be? How do I engage you in a way? Because if she doesn't have that, we don't get this. And so I think seeing that, well, I almost hear that, it's very selfish. You're just finding yourself. And it wasn't that kind of a deal, but it was important to put first things first. Thank you. Our time's up. We'll have a little more time with you later this afternoon. We're happy to be here. Thank you.